Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's Weber Training Teleclass. My name is Nicole Kenny. I'm delighted to be today's moderator and have the distinct pleasure of introducing today's faculty, Andrew Streifel. Andrew is a hospital environmental specialist with the Department of Environmental Health and Safety at the University of Minnesota. And he served on a number of guideline committees related to HVAC design for healthcare and has authored over 50 articles that have been published in academic and professional journals related to ventilation and water quality in healthcare. During his work as a healthcare consultant, he's been involved in the investigation of over 80 clusters of infections related to hospital air quality. And he served as a consultant in over 400 hospitals worldwide on a variety of indoor air quality issues, water microbial contamination, and has investigated clusters of bacterial infections due to unsanitary clinical practice. His current research interests involve sanitation validation and ventilation optimization without compromising safety in healthcare facilities. Andrew, take it away.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. Paul has been so kind through the years to invite me to give presentations, and so today I will sort of begin with my first love, and that is water quality. I began in water. I went into ventilation for a while, now back to water with issues that unfortunately create the deja vu. The next slide really shows my laboratory. At the University of Minnesota, we have somewhere around 4 million square feet of academic health, about 2 million of that. Well, actually, with the campus on the other side of the river, we have somewhere close to 3.5 million square feet. We have a pediatric and a adult bone marrow transplant unit, and we have the distinction of supposedly performing the first successful bone marrow transplant under Dr. Robert Good back in 1968. We are challenged continually because we're always under construction. We are always involved with some kind of disruption of our utilities. And the next slide shows my first and earliest interactions with a national presentation on hospital air and water, the infection connection, made on my Macintosh back in 86 when I presented to the national APIC somewhere in these United States. Infection control was really initiated in the 60s because, as an industry-leading institution in a variety of disciplines, immune-compromised patients with our transplant program is really foremost in a mode of protection, preventing the infections that can occur in a host that is not immune-competent. We've seen technology advances here with our ability to transplant. As early on in my career, a dialysis technician in a progressive transplant program, we went from 30 transplants a year back in the late 60s, early 70s, to now somewhere close to 300 patients. And certainly cancer treatment here is an advanced technology with about 200 to 250 bone marrow transplants. Both pediatric and adult, and of course advanced surgeries, really make us aware of the fact that the interaction between the environment with the susceptible patient and personnel is a very important consideration in interrupting the chain of infection. The next slide shows water systems in healthcare and the types of water that we need to think about. Drinking water, of course, dialysis water, which has actual environmental standards, a laboratory, which also has, in the United States, the College of Academic Pathologists, recommendations for water quality, depending, again, on what kind of procedures require it. Tissue culture, for example, would require the highest level of water in preparation with a reagent grade 1, whereas just rinsing a glassware would require reagent grade 3, a lack of minerals but a little microbial concern because the levels are rather high in a lot of that water. Whereas the reagent grade 1 has very low microbial content. Therapeutic water, again, for lithotripsy, if people still do that, or so even the pools and some of our rehab, and then cooling water, which is we call process water and fire management water, which is really a soup in that setting. The next slide really shows what we all need to know about when it comes to water quality investigations or understanding water quality. And the two graphics that are on that page essentially show a depiction of the basin that Minneapolis-St. Paul sits in here in Minnesota with the detail is not very fine. A number of surface water lakes and rivers and the arrows below that demonstrate the flow of water in the various aquifers below us. We draw our water for drinking for all of our purposes from either surface water or from groundwater. And in these United States, the majority of water sources are really well water. The advantage of well water is it's stable for long periods of time. Of course, if it's rather close to the surface, that is not going to hold true. But in reality, it's a stable product water to produce product, and we won't spend much time with that. But what really important is most of the populations in these United States receive surface water as their drinking. And that surface water is subject to change, and that's why we need to think of how that water is treated. What they do in Seattle is a lot different than what we do here in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Likewise, as we look around the United States, as our water sources change and their stability as well as lack of stability from seasonal variation, we need to think about how that water is treated. And I certainly do and have been very interested in this topic for a long, long time. The next slide shows environmental bioload. They're all around us. The body is a hero. We can withstand a great number of exposures, depending again on how we approach this. But natural water has a whole variety of potential for maintaining a bio load, and that is to be reckoned with, especially when we start treating those immune compromised patients. The drinking water standard in these United States is set at a less than one colony forming unit of coliform per 100 mils. That does not take into account anything except the fact that we don't have fecal organisms or the potential of fecal organisms in that water. Fermenters aren't there. But if we also consider the other part of the drinking water standard, we are allowed up to 500 colony-forming units of heterotrophic plate count bacteria. This is the issue that can create a source to find amplification points and to create biofilm within hospital water systems, and that's an important point to consider. The next slide shows alert organisms from a microbiological lab in our institution that I have reacted to in the past. I've seen them all. They are here and around us. They might be in various locations, which I'll begin to talk about here momentarily, but these have all been part of my professional experience. And honestly, a lot of places don't notice these until they become resistant, and that is a question we have in our minds. These bugs grow fast, doubling time in some instances, 20 minutes. That's not true for the typical mycobacteria. They are just perhaps a little bit slower, but yet these microorganisms do grow rather rapidly. The next slide is one that we got from Serva et al., talking about a reservoir for risk associated with water quality in some instances in that article. And it really shows, again, that unbeknownst to me until I read this not too many weeks ago, that we have a fair number of deaths due to Pseudomonas aeruginosa in the United States. But again, that could be due to the fact that a person's at end of life and they'll grow anything, and my goodness sake, that's the sixth thing on the list of complications that individual has. Certainly, we have to take it with a grain of salt, but the reality is there are other waterborne pathogens besides Pseudomonas, and with Pseudomonas, we need to consider how we culture it, and the fact that it's there certainly can create infections in our most compromised patients, especially those that are burned. What's happening here is that we recognize that we do have some waterborne bacteria that are a problem. Legionella is the primary one that we are often concerned about. So what we want to be very aware of, and what the American Society for Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning Engineers has proposed, is that we establish a risk assessment for water systems, especially in commercial buildings, but I should say especially in healthcare and hospitality, where Legionella has been an issue. So this standard is called Standard 188, and its intention is to prevent Legionellosis. but it's also fully aware of biofilm development within a building, a commercial building, most notably for us, the healthcare facility, that we need to think about that hazard analysis of critical control points. This is a good way of thinking about where our issues are and how much concern we should have for that. But it's well understood that the immune-compromised host with the things that we face here at the university, we should consider that a primary risk factor, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Environmental critical control points also include where's the water come from, how it's chlorinated, how's the hot water system developed, as well as how are we managing our cooling towers. The design or control for water bacteria is also associated with the piping material. Is it plastic? Is it copper? Is it have a metal ion effect? Is it galvanized metal? How should we think about those things? Water temperature is also an issue. I worked with a hospital recently that had Legionella moved into a new building, and they hadn't commissioned their hot water system yet. They had an awkward situation when Legionella showed up. There are also operational issues, again, water flow rate, timers, how well that system is balanced. Do you have some water hammer arresters in place? And also then you can add to that, is your region developing a drought? Have there been fires which cause water to flow backwards? Do you have a water main leak that, again, creates backflow conditions that will cause problems? Water stagnation, again, is an issue, one that I could spend a lot of time talking about these days, because as you know, when we build our buildings, we have punch lists. We say that sink is good. Does it flow water? Yes, it flows water. Good. Does the water flow from both sides? Yes, it flows. Then they turn the water off, and it sits for a year. Plenty of time as stagnation to cause problems. And again, after disasters, oh my goodness, who knows what to do under those circumstances. The next slide shows a depiction of what a risk assessment might look like, and that is to understand all the water interactions we have within our healthcare facility. Where does it reach the patient? Where does the patient utilize that water, and what can we do to mitigate risk in those settings? Again, this is supposed to be normative language, which means essentially that we must follow it in order for our risk management team to feel assured that we are okay, and perhaps even for insurance to say that we don't have an issue with ice machines, steam tables, dishwashers, or even drinking fountains, showers. There are a variety of locations, including that fountain that may develop Legionella out in the lobby. So we need to think about that, and it will be part of our considerations here as we move forward. One of the questions we have is, of course, is are the water bacteria resistant in our devices? We found that we needed to flush our water. You can see in the sink as we built a new building a year or so ago, as we were getting closer, we began flushing the systems, and our water systems, and we had laborers doing that work for us in order to keep our water quality good. In addition to that, we have to look at how we maintain our ice machines. And these can be both our drinking water as well as our ice machines, where a lot of the drinking water comes from, can be subject to stagnant water. And the slide below is just some work. Some of the students that I have are working on, do you see resistance in the isolates that we have in the hospital? And we've taken some group of antibiotics, more of the generic version of the variations off those, and just to see, and you can see some variation there, but again, none within the minimum. So again, it's of concern, but does not seem to be moving forward. As I said, seems like the docs get excited when we have resistance showing up, and what causes that resistance, we really don't know. But what we do know is that when we have stagnant water, we can have biofilm buildup. Construction causes water stagnation. And in addition to that, due to water conservation methods here in Minnesota, at my institution, University of Minnesota Medical Center, part of my job is to keep track of the water usage for white wastewater discharge reporting, because we are an industrial user of water. We have noticed that our water usage has gone from 56 million gallons of water a year to 25 million gallons of water over 13 years. This is a part of changing out our chemical processors to digital. We had many of those. We had two large medical gas machines that used water to cool, and that in itself, those two machines reduced our water usage by 3 million gallons of water a year. So in addition to that, the waterless soaps. Some people think the automatic faucets might be a way of reducing water usage. No, I don't think so. It's those large sources where we have made efforts to reduce water usage that make that less water usage. Now, we size our pipes for a lot of usage, but we are actually not using as much, and that in itself has created potential biofilm development in our pipes at healthcare facilities, especially if you don't use some of the standard piping materials. Factors in water resistance, again, should next slide should look at from a bacterial point of view, several factors. Clumping, creating that biofilm is an important one to protect the colony. The biofilm is an incredibly interesting issue, and certainly certain qualities, which I'm not going to talk about from that slide, are available to the bacteria to share and potentially develop into a biofilm. Another interesting aspect of operating criteria for a hospital in the upper left-hand corner is pretty much the common design that we see in these United States, and that is you have a water riser with loops going off of it to feed the various water sources within the healthcare institution. The rest of the slides are a European design, which I saw some years ago in a Legionella outbreak. Again, one that is driven by energy saving, one that is driven by a process that seems to be slightly independent of infection control or without awareness to infection control. This particular design, again, created a condition which is much too difficult to elaborate on that had Legionella as a source and created quite an uproar at that European hospital some years ago. So where things are happening that really potentially might be there to save energy and save water, but might create an infection control risk that we are informing you about today. The next slide speaks to biofilm development. The bacteria are there. They need a place to grow in the second phase and the third phase and fourth phase into a large mass that begins to shed. The sessile colony is that which is stuck somewhere. And as it becomes planktonic, those microorganisms break off. It's hard to believe, but supposedly their characteristics change as they get into the water and start floating away. There is a synergy going on with a multitude of polymicrobial mass that way beyond me, but these guys are going to win in the long runs, but we're going to try our best to keep it from happening until it needs to happen. So, of course, it's a challenge because biological in the next slide, the biological bacterial attachment is there. They like plastic. They want to stick to it. And certainly we see that the Legionella likes a whole bunch and Aeromonas likes a whole bunch of things. And copper, of course, is a good product but yet expensive. So we have a tendency in construction to move away from that. And, of course, they want plastic. So does that plastic create an opportunity for bacteria to attach and develop a biofilm? Good luck at trying to get that out of there. And that certainly is what we are faced with in some of the publications that have been coming out of late. The next slide shows what can happen to a pipe. There are drought conditions. There are a variety of conditions that can cause a pipe to deteriorate. So we need to think about what it's made out of, as I just stated, the operations. Do we fill the pipes and then leave them sit? Will that create a biofilm phenomenon within that particular project? Yeah. How do we disinfect it? We tried disinfecting and the bacteria came back, huh? So again, it's not a permanent thing because it's very difficult to disinfect once the system is up and running, given all the branches and things that go off of that feeder line that goes up and down and around the hospital. Monitoring, what are you going to look for? Chlorine, that's what I'd like to look for, but that doesn't always work because the stagnation creates conditions, and besides the fact that some of those bacteria have a waxy coat, they can resist back to the chlorine or chloramine in our instance in our facilities. Flow rates are important. The water does stagnate, and of course, the warmer it is, to a certain extent, the ideal temperature for them to grow is often in the summertime. Next slide shows where we can get biocontamination. Certainly, it's not perfect. We have our city uses 90 to 100 million gallons of water a year at peak. Certainly, as the seasons change and we go from groundwater to runoff water, we see various changes that create opportunities within that distribution system to develop a biofilm. Most of the time, it's not going to affect much, and certainly a lot of these things are insidious, but we are healthy. We do not seem to be bothered by an awful lot of the bacteria that are common in water. When the guidelines for environmental infection control, next slide, speaks to waterborne, the spread, control of the spread of waterborne microbes. We certainly need routine prevention of that within the distribution system, and we rely on our municipality disinfection to deal with that. Of course, there are limitations, especially when we find out that chlorine doesn't make it to the end and we have to put boosters in, or if we have chloramine, it develops a resistant microbe within that distribution system. So we think about what happens to that distribution system when we need repairs. Broken water mains allow for back siphonage into of the muck that that break creates. We've investigated some of those things here in the years gone by. So it certainly, we are aware that we get into our distribution systems, and we do contaminate them, and we do try to chlorinate contamination out of those areas. Our goal is, again, is to try and control Legionella, which is insidious and underreported, and we do have also know the CDC, through CDC, that dialysis water quality is important, and they do emphasize the maintenance of ice machines, and this is a real challenge for folks these days. There are a number of other devices that are out there, but it all gets down to the fact in the next slide that there are a variety of places where we put prosthesis in. There are a variety of places where we have restricted flow. We've got lots of competition in the mouth, but when we alter that with some swish and swallow type antibiotic, or we certainly, the next water that goes into that, if there are some bacteria, there could be a source of clinical concern, especially if that sputum culture is done routinely on a compromised group of patients. So we know that if these bacteria that are water associated, coming from that biofilm somewhere, it gets inside of us, and we do have publications to talk about that shortly, it can create problems. We first began dealing with water in the next slide when Dr. Kolff had his beginning dialysis equipment. We're going to talk a little bit now about the various kinds of water and where we found reservoirs from my experience in the past. And Dr. Kolff utilized rather crude methodologies. We did not have immune-suppressing drugs. We had 9 opportunities. There were supposedly 9 cut-down sites on a human body, and when we put that, as you can see, that garden hose, hook a patient up and run it through the cat gut, they were lucky they survived that procedure. But the next slide shows that dialysis has advanced remarkably. It is a place where water comes close to blood. There is a standard due to the fact that those people on chronic dialysis, and there are a fair number of them now in this government-funded healthcare end-stage renal disease program, we know that bacteria are part of a standard that we our health department requires us to manage because you see that there is a standard associated, a ANSI standard, and an AMI standard that talks to the level of bacteria, colony-forming units per milliliter, and it is supposedly going to become more stringent. There's a difference between the water that makes the dialysate, which is a mixture of isotonic a concentrate that makes a solution that grows well. Comes in contact, the indirect contact across a thin micron-sized membrane, and the potential for endotoxin to get across that is great. This is one of my first endeavor into dialysis was, into environmental microbiology was investigating febrile reactions in our patients that were waiting transplantation. I'd love to tell that story, but I can't. The fact is that we have an endotoxin standard and a bacterial standard, and the endotoxin standard is rather challenging because our drinking water has a fair amount of endotoxin in it just because. So dialysis water has a variety of devices that I cut my teeth on. The next slide shows various carbon filters, various storage tanks and UV lights, various kinds of piping glass, polyvinyl chloride, carbon filters. My goodness, we had all kinds of opportunities to manage these and the water quality in these for the last 40 years. 30 some years, I guess it is, maybe 35, dealing with quality control. And I still do that today in managing our dialysis water systems. And again, this is the first environmental bioload kind of standard that came about I'm aware of. Here we have the ANSI standard as it's written in 92-93. It's been referenced in some of the other CDC documents. I believe it's being updated. This is the slide I use, and again, it pretty much reiterates what the previous slide did. And again, it's just a backup type of support slide. As we look at the reservoir for bacteria, I've seen it in the hoses, the stagnant water, hydrotherapy tanks. My goodness, we did a lot of that way back when. I think they're not as common as they used to be. Ice machines are still a current topic. We've seen brushes cause problems as well as water pumps and dialysis, and we're going to talk about some of these momentarily. This is an adaption from a hospital epidemiology and infection control. Dr. Mayhall's, one of their chapters, Dr. Flattery, made this nice chart showing where we can pick up various bacteria. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have some of those in the other. These things can show up just about anywhere. But it shows that there's opportunity to find bacteria, and how we use water in a clinical setting is an important factor. We're not going to get rid of all the bacteria, just like we're not going to get rid of all the aspergillus in the air. How do we protect our patients? How do we recognize where those sources are and how we should wash our hands afterwards, right? It's the hand-washing issue, because we can pick it up from a number of places. Next slide. And we need to think about breaking the chain of infection, and that is understanding the sources, the reservoirs, and how those reservoirs get to the patient, mostly with us, but in the case of a shower and even the respiratory therapy equipment, there are ways that those bacteria can get in and cause problems, especially those when we're concerned about the water bacteria. The next slide shows one of my experiences with endoscope forceps. While this is a long time ago, not knowing, again, what current clinical practice, because we won't let it happen here, we this particular ultrasound, which never had its water changed, was creating an aerosol that floated down onto some bronchoscopes that were right in that area. So obvious reservoirs, I think, are important. Next slide. This ice machine was a source of serratia. If you look closely at the little picture on the right, if we could blow it up, which you can't. There's some milky water in there, and that was full of serratia marcescens, causing some wound infections. We speculate due to the fact that we gave mouth care with that ice, and they potentially coughed it into some wounds every now and then, so it was difficult to figure out. But one of these types of devices and how they're manufactured, how they have reservoirs within them, and where we get our drinking water for our most compromised patients really still continues to be a source of concern in a lot of institutions. The next slide was another issue that I investigated. This was this device was being used to clean endoscopes in a maybe it was the place was cheap. I don't know what they were, but again, it this was never intended to be disinfected. These devices was some kind of pulsating device that was reasonably common some years ago for mouth care. They decided they could clean endoscopes with it and ended up with some concerns, patient-related concerns on endoscopy, bronchoscopy, and the way that they clean their devices. The next slide was a situation I investigated some years ago where the drinking water or the wash water contaminated the mixer. The mixer then was fed to short bowel babies or the babies that didn't have a digestive system that's working well, got mixed in with the whey that we were using. Some of the packages you see there ended up contaminating the kids and developing explosive diarrheal situations. We switched to the way that we mix our things with the malt machine, and that has and they're still there. Amazingly, after all these years, they're still a pretty much common practice to not have these mixers on the ward because it can take good water and turn it bad because we can't clean those mixers. Again, water related indirectly. This particular, the next slide shows some a situation where we had Burkholderia sepatia end up in the bloodstream of quite a few patients, and we found it associated with spiking bags. And then this technology has probably changed, but as they pooled cryoprecipitate in people with DIC, they ended up contaminating the water, getting into the blood bags. Ever wonder why we thaw blood products now in plastic? Well, this is one of the reasons. We ended up with three deaths due to that, and it was around 10 to the 8th per mil. And we assumed that water was good, even though we put povidone iodine, antiseptic povidone iodine, inappropriate use of povidone iodine in that. This is something that happened 20-some years ago, at least. So it's, again, a situation that we need to understand what we're doing with the water. The next slide shows some cardioplegia machine, and the water from the cardioplegia machine ended up causing infections in the patients, and it was due to the fact that the pump techs were not washing their hands as they used the equipment. And again, one of those things when the old days when we used ice to cool, and now those devices are self-contained, but they still have a lot of bacteria in them. So anytime someone uses the Hansen connector to hook up the cardioplegia machine to the pump, we have to be aware that those bacteria there are fairly high numbers, and simple hand washing, hand cleansing would be a way of controlling those from moving around as you all as vectors and getting into the patient. These devices, these blood warmers, great device, one of the best innovations in saving blood and being able to use it as needed, is a water reservoir. That water reservoir should be known to people. When I asked the anesthesia aide about that water, she said, that's sterile water, right? Just because you put sterile water in there doesn't mean it's going to stay sterile. So the issue here is as you disconnect the patient as they're giving blood, you disconnect the patient first and not the machine first, because as you disconnect the water reservoir, you get a little bit of water on your fingertips. And we know good and well from our experience that a million organisms, and even if you have a thousandth of a mil on your fingertip, that's still a thousand organisms. So how many do you need? I don't know, but I think we should avoid getting them to the patient in the first place. The next slide shows issues related with biofilm and mycobacterial diseases, Chelonia and Fortuitum, Gordonii, Kansansi, and all of these have been around and caused problems in a variety of locations. There's a lot more information than this on where these have caused biofilm, but it is important to say because we had a mucogenicum problem at our institution, which we published under the lead author, Dr. Susan Klein, from the University of Minnesota, on a mycobacterial cluster that we saw some years ago. And the interesting thing about it, while we saw it on the EpiCurve, the Minneapolis water chloramine level was monitored, is continually monitored, about 300 yards from our hospital, and they have records that show every third day what the chloramine level is, as well as what the heterotrophic plate count is. And as what we can see here quite easily is that the chlorine level, chloramine level, was fine until mid-August, and boom, the level went away, probably due to heat, water stagnation, some other issues within the city, but we had a drop, and during that time, the arrows depict the times when we started seeing infections, sepsis in our bone marrow transplant patients. And as we investigated, we found that on one side of a wall, we could have a shower, and on the other side, a sink. And when we tested both sides of the water, we saw about two orders of magnitude difference in count. So one side had was a reservoir, the other side was straight water. And when we took the shower heads apart, we didn't find it necessarily in the shower head, but we found it in the biofilm of the washer that was holding the shower to the wall and keep from leaking. That particular washer was made out of a cellulose product. It could be a soft rubber product too, but they're intended to stop a seal. But they're wonderful biofilm producers, and we did get millions of organisms off of that per mil in a 100-mil milk bottle, shaking it up for a period of time, and we ended up with millions of organisms. So it only attests to the fact that if you get a biofilm going somewhere, they can seed the location. And as a remedy for us, that loop, as you can see on the next slide, on the left side is looped and can sit for weeks in a bone marrow room, or you can hang it, dangle it, and that's what we did. Flushing works. You can see from the data there that when you flush the pipes, you can get the numbers down quite dramatically, and this is a sign that is common in our bone marrow transplant rooms to avoid the issues we've had in the past. We've also looked at silver on the next slide. It seems to work. We still have issues, but yet this is a potential to have silver-lined water distribution system within the ice machine as well as in our shower heads that would prevent bacteria from getting to the patient. This shower head could also potentially be filtered. Construction is also a part of the potential for infection. And pardon me, from my experience, the Minnesota section and Dr. Leonard Bermel from Providence in New Hampshire, no, Rhode Island, I believe, demonstrated or described the Legionella after a construction project outage at his facility at Providence Hospital. In Minnesota, we've seen a few of these, most recently when we moved the water pipe because a foundation was supposed to go there in building our new hospital. We found that we got Elizabethickii mesenteroides, but it's a former flavobacterium, and they make it into a word that I can't quite say. It takes me years to do that, but that's okay. The Pseudomonas aeruginosa, again, was also associated with an outage on a sink, a hand-washing sink that was used by parents. It had sat stagnant for 6 weeks while we repaired our neonatal ICU, expanded it, and didn't flush the sink well enough afterwards. So that biofilm can be developed. In the case of the construction and disrupting the water lines, that showed up in some of our respiratory therapy equipment. We need to flush the water. It makes a difference, and certainly we need to do that if we have issues with our contaminated water. Legionella is often the source of most concern. Legionella can be found in a number of locations within a healthcare facility, and certainly you see that list before you. The ideal temperatures are there in the next slide, as well as the potential of stagnation, the things that we previously talked about. You can see the scale and sediment, especially at the bottom of your hot water tanks. That's why a lot of folks have gone with instantaneous hot water heaters, and certainly this will be the discussion point of some of the risk-associated areas within a healthcare facility that will be looked at with the Legionella standard of care coming out in the ASHRAE 188. We can prevent and control bacteria. Some people say you should culture water, and this comes from the CDC. And if you found that you look in patients and others like ourselves, wait for it to show up in a patient, and then we look in the water. There are things you can do to the water. We're keeping residual chlorine in it. The unfortunate thing, that stagnated water makes the chlorine go away, especially in those dead legs, and that certainly can create sometime conditions where Legionella can be found. The next slide shows some biofilm and corrosion. We saw that before. It's a lot more common, unfortunately, than we care to admit, especially in the galvanized pipes where there's some the cationic whatever forces make it rust and can create problems, especially on the horizontal. We take a lot of fixtures out of service in our healthcare facilities because we're constantly remodeling and we end up with dead legs, and those dead legs can be reservoirs, especially for the heterotrophic bacteria, not necessarily Legionella, but our primary often concern is the Legionella. The next slide began showing the drinking water disinfection. You're probably aware of some of these. I'm not going to spend time with them, but a lot of folks now are going with the continuous disinfection if they feel they have a problem, either using silver copper or chlorine dioxide. They're both gaining notoriety and are being installed as part of the risk assessment at those respective hospitals around the United States, those especially with high populations of immune-compromised patients. The next slide shows some of the issues associated with the silver ion electrochemical activation, again, of water using silver and copper in that instance. It needs to be in place where it can go through and disinfect the water. There might be limitations to these due to the fact that your capacity in the water is either increasing or decreasing. In our instance, it's decreasing and maybe be making these more effective. But these are found in quite a few hospitals around the United States, and their success is probably fairly good in controlling Legionella, but they, again, select for those other atypical microorganisms from my experience in visiting with hospitals that have installed these. One of the things that we have to be thankful for in the field of public health is the prolonged life due to the sanitation of our water. That chlorination is presented to us in the United States and North America in two forms, either a free available chlorine or combined chlorine. And we see that in the 90s, about 23% of municipalities used monochloramine disinfection. And in our city, that's because we do not want to form trihalomethanes, because the EPA says you shall not form trihalomethanes, you should keep the levels less than one part per million, I believe it is. We are mandated by EPA to not use free available chlorine, but to combine it with ammonia to form a more stable product that has a persistence that reaches the end of our distribution system. The thing that's great about that, and from a Legionella perspective, is that while recognizing where the risk is in the transplant programs, we also recognize the fact that 31 of the outbreaks investigated with Dr. Kuhl and his paper, which show that the association was really with free available chlorine. Those really were the factor, and monochloramines were not a factor in many of those situations. Our risk assessment would say we have chloramines, but we have to deal with the other bacteria, where we don't have to say so much about Legionella in our community, because we don't see that much endemic or clusters of infection associated with Legionella. There are sporadic cases around our state, but yet again, understanding that really helps us look and see where our risk really lies. Dr. Gahood in the Royal Infirmary in Glasgow has some of the most experience with chlorine dioxide, and certainly it is electrochemical activation, a process using brine to develop disinfection products that then help our distribution system maintain low levels of bacteria, and this is becoming more common. The disadvantage of chlorine dioxide, quite simply, is that it has a requirement that we have to keep track of the chlorides. And that means we have to have a wet test lab and be able to monitor it. And it is an issue, and one that makes that user a secondary water treatment location and subject to additional problems associated with regulation. Cooling towers can be a source for Legionella, and certainly when the smokers go out and hide behind the cooling tower, their propensity to grow in charcoal environments puts those smokers at risk, and so we do need to maintain our towers. The next slide again shows some of the qualities the tower should have. Normally we're not going to install a bad tower. We just have to make sure we maintain it. And that requires testing and record keeping, because the more we maintain our towers, the more efficiently they will run. The more efficiently they will run, the lower the bacterial counts will be, because they have to be in order for that heat transfer across those cooling coils. We need to maintain them in order to keep them under control for their purpose, and that is to get the heat out of the building. And secondarily, it will also help protect from Legionella. They do need to be maintained, and we do need to make sure that that happens. And the next slide shows some of the pumps that we have. We put several kinds of chemical up there, again, to avoid that resistance that could develop. And this is a part of our efficiency, again, for energy as well as for preventing infections. The next slide shows some aspects of automatic faucets. This is an issue that the folks at Hopkins had brought up, the fact that these automatic faucets have rubber surfaces inside of them. It's important for all of us to recognize the fact that we have plastic and rubber surfaces in our water distribution systems. They come in the form of water hammer arresters. They come in the form of surge tanks. They come in the form of automatic faucets, of regular faucets. Some people even put in plastic pipes. All of them can be harborage points. And as we turn that device on and begin the water flowing, that first flow water has a lot of bacteria. If I had a little more time to develop, we are developing some flushing material on faucet management that we're looking at our institution now. Flushing works. It's just how long are you willing to flush? Because that 3/8 inch piece of pipe runs all the way over across the room into this sink, and then it branches out and goes to the sink in the bathroom. And how much water does that represent? 15-second flush, 30-second flush, 60-second flush, and then we have to be sure that the water is moving. So there is a push to not use water as much in healthcare facilities, and it's the stagnation of the water that ends up growing on those plastic surfaces and create that biofilm. The next slide again shows a manual faucet, and that first drop water is really an issue. The folks at Hopkins were kind enough to send me these slides, and again, it is a topic of concern in water quality management, and from the number of papers I've downloaded in the last few days on some investigation I'm working on now, it certainly has been out there for a while and will become even more a factor as our immune-compromised patient population increases. We're changing the inside of our hospital, getting more intensive care beds. A lot of our other patients are becoming more acute, and certainly these rubber surfaces and the exposure of that water, avoidance of water isn't always a factor. We cannot do that all the time, and certainly we need to recognize when we have a community-acquired waterborne issue versus a hospital-acquired, because they're certainly out in the community, because I know I don't use the water as much as I should, but I am paranoid. I let it flush. I get that way after a while. But anyway, you need to think about these things if you have those immune-compromised patients. Unfortunately, I think about it, and I'm not immune-compromised, but yet this is something that's with us. We have remedies. Next slide shows filtration. Certainly that first drop water coming out of that head, that neck, might only represent a few seconds flush, and we have seen great efficacy in that few second flush. But by the same token, if it doesn't go away, how are you going to take care of it? And there's where that point of use filters. There is a manufacturer that has these. They can be put into shower heads as well as into the sinks, and certainly it works. But our water has a flocculant in it. Most of our water has it, and that will plug these devices. But they've been out now because of large surface areas, 30 days to change them. Is it cost more to put these in and avoid an infection? I guess that's really one of a full-time equivalent question, whether or not worth it to hire somebody to do this day in and day out. So how many beds, how many of them are immune compromised? What's the microorganism? It's a tough decision to put in filters, but they are a solution. And they do work, and there is evidence that they do work with some papers, again, published in the recent past. The next slide, again, shows water sources. They're out there. My experience is limited, but I've looked at an awful lot of these things. There are more that I didn't take pictures of, but yet they have been a part of my experience, and certainly I hope that has been helpful to all of you listening to this program. This more sophisticated program that I see on the next slide, again, is just a rendition of what we talked about earlier. We can get things off of surfaces from water. It can be transmitted. The chain of infection, again, is really what it's all about, how we can avoid getting the reservoir, keeping the reservoir away from that immune-compromised patient, which is really the canary, if you will, for finding these kinds of problems. The next slide shows what I think about often when I suspect an infection associated with water bacteria. Determining the culture site, if it's sputum, scratch, you know, what could that be? If it's blood, then you need to think about something else. But yet, you know, we've got to look at those sources, and I've certainly done this quite a bit in my career, and certainly the fact is that I have a laboratory. I have an environmental microbiology laboratory that allows me to look, and that certainly is a privilege because I know how hard it is to get the clinical micro lab to do some of these methods because they weren't taught it in the first place. So that's been my career, something that I've been privileged to do, and it has helped me look at where these bugs come from. If it's a wound infection, we've seen it from ice machines as well as showers. There was several of them that I could get off on if we had the time. Bloodstream in sepsis, again, that was a showers that got into some three-way stop, Cox and Hickman's. The bathing methods, certainly those are ways that they can get in. Of course, the procedures, what they do to you while you're in the hospital. Of course, hand transmission, when we know where the reservoirs are, like the cardioplegia equipment or even those blood-warming devices, we can take the common-sense approach and cleanse our hands. That's still a major factor in preventing transmission. The water, the bacteria are around us. They're in the air. They're in not so many much water bacteria, but certainly we certainly have bacteria all around us, and we have many opportunities to pick them up. And as we know so often, that hand washing is a big part of that. But now you say, oh, you're washing your hands with bacteria-laden water. Well, if you dry your hands and you know what you're doing, especially if you're manipulating the access, blood access, you know what you're supposed to do to bundle that to prevent the infection. So again, it's we have to think and we need to be aware of how to do that. The method to culture bacteria, on the next slide, advantages and disadvantages. A lot of laboratories will put a drop of water on the plate and spread it around. It doesn't let us see the sensitivity that we may need for certain investigations. Broth, again, it's very easy to do, very low tech. You drop some water into a broth tube. It grows the most dominant organism. He who grows the fastest gets the mostest, or something like that. I mean, they will dominate, and that might not be your problem organism. For example, Pseudomonas might grow a whole lot faster than atypical, and you might have an atypical issue. Membrane filters, again, is what we've been using my whole career. They're very sensitive to low concentrations. It's very specialized. It's a great thing to utilize. However, it's expensive, high tech, and lucky for us, we have a laboratory to look at that type of situation. Water has been a big part of my career. I've certainly breezed through this fairly quickly. The last slide shows some of my experiences with both buildings. We've got one across the river, slightly different water supply. We've put wells in both of these buildings. We know good and well the well water in some respects is better quality, but we also know that's that segment between the well water and where we tie in to our drinking water can be a source of a lot of stagnated bacteria. And being aware of these things allows us to flush that. As long as they keep inviting me to meetings when these things and our staff, our team, is aware of it, we can do some preventative measures to keep those bacteria from reaching the reservoir or the host from the reservoir to the host to create those problems. So I certainly could go on. I seem to be a little early here today. I maybe should have put in some more slides or maybe I've elaborated a little long. With that, I'll turn it back to Nicole.
Thank you, Andrew, and thank you for a very informative seminar. I think for some of us, you've probably highlighted the fact that just because the water in our facilities is safe to drink, that we cannot overlook its potential as a reservoir to cause disease. I know you had alerted to an issue with ice machines, and I think I may have to start ordering drinks without ice cubes in the future for fear of the slimy, gross water that you showed the picture of.
I could come up with one more anecdotal situation that I failed to elaborate on, but I don't know if that's appropriate at this time.
Well, sure. I think we have enough time for that.
One of the things I think that's important that I didn't mention, especially in the Elizabeth Tickey Eye situation, was the fact that while it was, we feel the root cause was the stagnant water or disruption of the water line, the bottom line really amounted to an inappropriate use of water in a clinical setting. And unfortunately, you know, I hate to say this about us, but yet respiratory therapy was rinsing a device that went into the airway with tap water. They thought it was dry. They dropped it into a urine cup, and it ended up just sitting there. The urine cup protected it from evaporation, and it was a very elaborate electrode that was for one of the respiratory therapy devices, and it didn't evaporate. And again, the doubling time caused a significant number to be increased, and as it went in the airway, it blew right into the lung. We see that when people have gone to rinse certain tubes, gastric tubes, the bacteria, they didn't let the water run, they didn't let it flush, and created a situation where we had an issue with a patient. So it's very important that we use water appropriately in the clinical setting, especially if we're dealing with medical devices. We're not going to be able to eliminate all the bacteria, but we're certainly going to be able to think about how we use water. Sorry about that, but I just had to say that one last thing.
No, I think that's a great point to add at the end. And again, on behalf of Weber Training, I hope everybody enjoyed today's teleclass. If you do have any questions for Andrew, please feel free to email him directly at the email address he's provided on his last slide. Or by all means, you can also email to info@webertraining.com, and Paul will forward any questions that he receives through that email address on to Andrew. And again, thank you everyone for joining today's teleclass.